Five, four, three, two, one.
That wasn't the only one thinking about that.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Rick Tewis, and welcome to another episode of At Random.
Jackson Matthews, I'm still here, to my left.
And I'm John Wordsworth. Not a Thunderbird, unfortunately.
It's the sixth Thunderbird.
That was inspired by that high-tech countdown that you did there, John, without the aid of a computer.
Well, you know, when you've got an iPad in your hand, you've got to sometimes get back to your roots.
Well, okay, so this show, let me just very briefly put a little bit of background together so that we can talk about that, and I'll chuck the details in a moment. Want to talk about, revisit again, UEFI, Microsoft, it's OEM licensing, and its strategy with ARM and tablet PCs and so on and so forth. But as you pointed out just before we kicked off, it's probably important to put a little bit of background into what these things are that we're talking about before we chuck out loads of tech terms that nobody understands.
We could have a show just full of acronyms, couldn't we?
Yeah, you could with this. In fact, in the article that I posted, the email that I sent to you was just a whole suite of acronyms that just landed themselves together. But anyway, we're off topic. So, let's get a bit of background together on... Stop it already. I'll get Jerry back and I'll phone Jerry and he'll kick your head in. Let's start with UEFI. John, do you want to...
Yeah, so I guess one of those things is quite complicated, so maybe we'll just sort of start from the top, really, I guess.
Yeah.
So old-fashioned computers, when you start them up, black screen, white writing... About 3 seconds of text flashes up on the screen and goes away.
That's where you hit the F2 to go into setup and
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff. And you have to jab the key several times, don't you? You wait and then you go tuk, 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 and then it goes entering setup. That's the bit you're talking about. That
precisely,
BIOS,
yeah.
Set,
so that's I think most people are aware of the word BIOS.
Yeah,
and that's like you say, that bit when you before your computer starts, but actually it's loading up all of the communications required for your operating system to talk to. Well, the rest of your computer, really. So that's like a little set of... This is how I understand it. It might not be spot on. But as I'm aware, the BIOS is essentially a little set of commands and instructions that your operating system can call, which will then get fed through to your motherboard. And then, obviously, everything's connected to your motherboard. So it's basically the way that...
There's a joke
OS,
in there somewhere. Everything's connected to your motherboard.
Your motherboard. But yeah, so... The way I see it is the BIOS is essentially the layer that sits between the physical hardware and your operating system. And that means you can have different bits of hardware. You know, they can change and get better without your operating system having to change every time to account for every little tiny instruction that a new hardware can do.
Yeah. And it plays a really important job because when you first start up the machine, of course, you've only got this... Like the BIOS chip has only got a tiny amount of memory and it can only do a very small number of jobs. So it checks a few things out on the board, as you rightly say, switches on the hardware, and then it does one really important job, and that is it goes to the disk drive, your main storage, and it looks at sector zero, the first track, the very first track, sector zero on the disk drive, which is the master boot record, and it looks for a bootloader, a little tiny piece of software that's a bootloader, and it basically drags that bit of software off the disk, plants it in memory, and then tells the processor, execute that. And the moment that happens, that's when the screen goes blank and you see this little tiny cursor up the left for a second. And then what happens next is you usually get like a Microsoft logo or something like that. And the moment that happens, or you get a grub menu that pops up with Ubuntu in it, or you get, as like with the Apple, it's all the same across the machines largely. With Apple, you'll get the little Apple symbol that flashes, the little Apple that pops up on the screen, and then it all goes quiet for a moment. And what happened is that bit for a moment there is the bootloader. That small piece of code, 512 kilobytes of code, runs in memory, and its job is to basically bootstrap the next section. So it then says, right, now I'm going to go and get the core operating system's kernel, and I'm going to load that into memory, and I'm going to run it. So it loads that into memory and run it, and then from there it splits depending on the operating system that you want to run. But it might drag in 2 or 3 megs of data off the disk, run the kernel. The kernel starts up, and it has a call routine that calls and it's something to start first. Like in Linux, it calls init, which is the first program that it runs. Init. West side, init. And init runs, and init effectively, in its job, is to then is to start up the kernel and then bring the operating system all the way up to speed. So it starts things like the network layer, so that all of a sudden, so your network devices can run. It might start your print subsystem. It might start your other services, like the USB drivers. It'll load all of those so you can see the USB keys. And then eventually it'll load a desktop and plonk a login in front of you. And so that's how you're essentially getting from BIOS all the way up the stack. And it's the BIOS, baby. That's the baby that gets you to desktop init.
And that's a basic input-output system?
Ah.
Is that right?
I think so. I'm not going to commit to that without looking up on Wikipedia.
If it's not exactly that, it's something to the same effect. Sweet. My acronyms are usually right, but I sometimes remember there's something which means the same, but with different words.
Yeah.
So, but it's essentially the input-output system between your hardware and your software.
Yeah.
But like you say, I mean, for the purposes of today, the most important thing is it's that very first step that takes you from a collection of bits of hardware to an operating system.
Yes,
that's the primary thing. But then about 10 years ago, people started realising, hang on, this BIOS chap, a bit limited. I guess that's probably one of the limitation on the size of it.
Yes.
So they're cramming more and more software into these little flash ROMs. But then whatever BIOS you had back in the day, whenever you hit F2 to set some options on it, it was always a blue screen with white writing on top.
Blue screen.
Yeah, but there was just no scope. There was no scope to do anything more than that in this tiny amount of RAM, memory on these chips. So it must have been about 10 years ago, I think, when Intel decided, in my mind, they kind of went, what would Apple do? let's take something which already works and make it better. So they had one of those moments and they thought, all right, the BIOS, it works, but it's not great. Let's make it better. So the boss at Intel came up with this new one, for which I do have the acronym written down, the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. But nice. If you turn on a PC nowadays, you just get the same kind of black screen of white writing when it boots up. But if you mash F2 quick enough, or F1, or delete, then you tend to see a nice interface now. I don't know if either of you have done it in the last sort of couple of years.
I've never seen one of these things, no.
But they're pretty nice now. I mean, I could boot the PC up and show you, but I fear it would kind of sound like there's some large asthmatic hamster in the background because it's got some beefy fans on it. But
so I'm picturing an asthmatic hamster with beefy fans on it. It looks awesome.
Something out of a sci-fi comic.
Yeah, like a Harrier jump jet, but like a hamster.
But here's a screenshot of...
I can't get that. My firewall didn't let me have hamsters with beefy fans. apparently those sites are blocked.
But here's a screenshot of what... Actually, this is... Conveniently, I just searched for UEFI screenshot, but here's a screenshot of my exact one, I think. Oh, it's the Asus one. It's very similar, though. But that's essentially what you get now when you push F2.
Oh, yeah.
So you get a nice, shiny, fancy user interface. Everything, the mouse works.
Yeah.
So it hooks into your USB mouse, loads up a little tiny set of USB drivers.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're a new computer user, it's probably... possibly all you've seen, you know.
How new are we talking? I mean, is this going to be on, like, is this on my machine? I don't even know about it. Or
not on your laptop, I don't think. It's pretty new.
I mean, it's been around for about 10 years, but people haven't really adopted it because the BIOS works.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, when you've got something that works and you've got all your software written, it's cheaper just to copy, paste, add a few methods for your new hardware than adopt the new thing. But this kind of UEFI... still plays the same role in booting your computer. It's just a lot more advanced than it used to be, so it offers a whole new set of features.
It's very shiny, but again, it's hardly seen, isn't it? That's the thing, is it's only when you press the F2 key that you go into there, and now you get this. You've got, well, I mean, what you can see here for our users, I mean, we might even be able to link to this screenshot in the notes, but you've got some bar, like little like feeder bars and dashboards and so on and so forth, and it looks really groovy and funky, but you don't look at it very often. With the laptop and PC market being so competitive, it's easy to understand why you wouldn't implement that, because it's an additional cost that, you know, the user hardly ever sees.
And what's quite cool is, so on my computer, when I mash F2, obviously you can see the hard drives at the bottom. You can drag and drop the little elements, so no more are you looking at this big list of text with weird long serial numbers next to all your hard drives going, which one's that?
Okay, you've spoiled it now.
But, you know, so there is a user benefit, albeit minor, but the UEFI... UEFI, I knew this acronym was going to catch me up, does come with a whole new bunch of features, which I guess, and the idea is it's meant to be extensible, so different manufacturers can make it do different things if they want to, while obviously they're still expected to do the same core things. I think you can actually boot most UEFI things into like a little command line environment where you can just type your command into it as well, so poking at it sort of thing.
Yes, yeah, I'm fairly sure that you've got those kinds of features and functionality into it.
But I think that was one of the ideas. I don't know if many people have done it yet. I'm sure a couple have, but I think quite a few of the ideas was that you wouldn't necessarily even need to boot from your hard drive. So people would be able to put, manufacturers could put a tiny little installation onto a flash chip and plug that onto the motherboard, say, and then the UEFI, you can mash, say, F7 when your computer's loading, and it just loads up a web browser in 3 seconds.
So it'd be a little bit like a live USB or something.
Like, but it would just, bam, it would load.
But it's in the machine. Yeah. That's nice. That would be really handy, because if you have like a big old lockup or something, and something that you can't salvage, but if I could just get into the data with that, you could.
No, good. So, I mean, I don't think many people have actually done that yet, but that's one of the things that UEFI enables.
Mm. So, now there are a few of the drivers that come to the table for this, and before I get my big club out again, I probably ought to just explain one of the other motivators. There are a few motivators for doing this and for changing from BIOS to UEFI. Not all about glossy magic. Things, there are some positive things that can be done with UEFI that are very helpful. In recent times, there's been a whole sequence of laptops and netbooks and small devices that have been brought out with dual operating systems. Some of those operating systems are Linux-based. In actual fact, all of the dual operating systems are all Linux-based to different degrees and different levels of abstraction. But, for example, HP, I'm not entirely sure what their foray is with the PC market at the moment, because it's been a bit of an off and on game. But they created something called the Webtop OS. And the idea there is that when you flip open your netbook and you switch it on, within 3 to 4 seconds, you've actually got a desktop in front of you. And it's not a Windows desktop, it's booting into a Webtop OS. And of course, that's using things like UEFI as a loader is a great way to do that, because you can effectively get to a usable desktop to play a bit of music, surf the web and answer some emails really quickly. Of course, that helps the netbooks compete with tablet PCs in terms of on speed time. So there's been some real positives there that have come from that. There are also some security implications. I mean, the cracker, and I use that word deliberately, because the media talks about hackers all the time. Oh, we've been hacked, and hackers. No, you haven't. Hackers are not bad people. That is not the bad ones. Crackers are bad people. But they've got more and more and more sophisticated. So we went through that scenario of how the BIOS boots up. Now, on a Windows machine, for example, virus gets in through your web browser, usually infects one of the binaries on your machine, your email client or whatever, and off it goes replicating and infecting and doing all bad stuff. And of course, you get antivirus software that can strip that out of the machine and so on and so forth. Now, the next level of sophistication with security stuff like that is where you obfuscate the system so that you damage the tools that would look for these viruses so they can't be seen. This is the kind of, essentially what a kind of rootkit might do. So you might break into the machine and change things like the find and the ls commands and so on and so forth, so that you say, list everything on the system except this one process, except this thing, this bad thing. And of course, then systems, the security white hats chasing after the cracker bad hats, if you like, then come up with rootkit discoverers to stop these exploits. So the virus writers and the malicious software writers have gone down through the layers, from attacking the programs that you run on your desktop to going down, 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 until they reach the kernel. Now, I explained to you, the bootloader boots the kernel, and that's the first thing that runs. If you compromise the kernel, so if you can...
See, I'm picturing a kernel with a moustache.
Yeah. Yeah, if you compromise the kernel, Nicky's chicken nuggets.
Yeah, I'm sure he had the candlestick in the dining room earlier.
But yeah, if you basically compromise at that level, so if you can get in at the kernel layer, you can't be detected.
Mm.
So there's a security hole here. Now, as things have got more sophisticated than the virus writers, what they can do is effectively get onto your machine, compromise the kernel, so that the next time the machine boots up, your infected machine, it can't be discovered.
Yeah.
So, UEFI tackles that problem by signing the kernel with a very specific key. So what you do is you effectively use an algorithm that creates a checksum of the kernel in its state, and you say, the kernel with this checksum and this key, this private key ID, is the thing that you can load. And if it hasn't got that, don't load it. And so, of course, yeah, you immediately lock that machine down. So now the virus writers... Now, Microsoft would pitch this as the end to all security problems. It isn't at all, because the virus writers will just go up two layers and get more sophisticated. So they'll just infect stuff above the kernel.
Yeah.
But they can attack at this level. So this creates a security enhancement that then starts, that then has some value. So those are the kinds of things that this UEFI bootloader can do that BIOS simply can't. So that's the background behind it.
Yeah, I think it's... I think there is one other minor point that's different, isn't it? But I think the BIOS kind of is expected to just run through and then boot off of an MBR disk, full stop.
Yeah.
Whereas the UEFI is basically running booting up into like a little programming environment, so it can make all these checks, can access your hard drive. They can even access networking and things. So they can go online and check your kernel's the latest version, and presumably download the latest if it's
there. Absolutely, yeah.
So there are some really cool benefits to this, but like you say, there are some other challenges that might come with that.
Yeah.
I mean, if it gets more sophisticated, is it likely to, I mean, coming at from a position of complete ignorance, I've no idea what the answer is, but is it more likely to compromise the reliability of, I mean, something simple like a BIOS will run the same way every time, but is there any potential for it getting knotted up in the same way that a lot of computer systems do? Is it sufficiently complicated for that?
I guess that's there's the potential there for concern, but I suspect this would be very hard and probably not something to worry about, but I guess there's no reason why crackers couldn't flash a UEFI. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that would be a really tough task because they would have to do it on a hardware basis. And most motherboards nowadays, at least, I don't know about the low-end ones, but I never buy a low-end one anymore. But they kind of have a double backup system for the BIOS anyway. They say BIOS, but obviously it's UEFI. So even if a hacker were to... If they managed to get exactly the right bit of hardware... So they scan for your motherboard and they've got a virus just for your motherboard, then they could replace the firmware with something which doesn't have the security in, say.
Yeah.
Or it starts sending spam without even turning on your computer.
That'll be what happens, yeah. They've got no imagination, these hackers. Yeah,
the spam's going out before you've even seen the Windows logo.
Yeah.
That's
all right, I can live with that. If I don't have to look at it.
There certainly will be ways to do that and ways to compromise the machine at certain levels. You know, perhaps by creating semi-intelligent hardware devices like USB sticks, that as USB sticks get more intelligence, or you put more intelligence on them because you're plugging them directly into the bus, if they've got enough intelligence they can access the hardware directly, you know, and then you could do stuff like that. So there's all kinds of clever things that, you know, that effectively take us off into the realms of security, you know, so maybe We could do a show on that, maybe get one of the security guys to come in and talk about some of those things.
Sure, yeah.
The really interesting point of controversy here, now we've touched upon this back in the past, so I want to make this connection now between UEFI and Windows 8, because we did talk about this in the past, and I know we talked about it on the show, and then I know, John, afterwards you felt, did we quite quote that right? Because I heavily abused Microsoft. and I would always stand by everything I say about that. But, you know, there was some issues about that. Was that fair and right? Because, you know, then Microsoft put press releases out of this, that and the other. So let's look at the background of that for a moment. The deal is this, which is that I talked about this security protection mechanism that effectively says the UEFI will only load the kernel of an operating system that it's got a signed key for. So that's great, because effectively it means that Microsoft can sell this as a security mechanism, as I said. But there's another nefarious possibility, and that is that, first of all, it becomes a potential copy protection mechanism for Microsoft, and it also becomes a lockdown mechanism. So, for example, Microsoft could only develop keys for Windows 8 and only provide UEFI keys for Windows 8 machines, therefore forcing everybody in the market who's buying a new PC to take Windows 8. Now, if you remember what happened when they had Windows Vista, and people went, we don't like Vista, you can piss off, and everybody went back to Windows XP and started doing all of that. Well, UEFI could essentially stop that, because Microsoft could say to the OEM licensees, right, if you want to have a license for our software, you have to put this key in your BIOS, we'll call it the BIOS rather than UEFI, which is a right mouthful. So you've got to put this in your bootloading BIOS, and then it'll only map against the Windows 8 software. So that, first of all, gives Microsoft a strong competitive advantage to force the consumers to adopt Windows 8. Now, this is something that they've not really done very often in the past, forcing consumers to upgrade to the latest version of software or the latest edition. So they're not known for it, but they might do it. You surely you can hear the irony in my voice there. They do it all the time, they're bastards.
I'm sure there won't be a problem. It all sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. So that's problem A. But there's another issue, and it becomes this. We did a show about your Ubuntu experiences.
Yes.
Now, right. If you had a UEFI bootloader on that with only keys for Windows, you can't run anything else on it.
Yeah.
So you couldn't load Ubuntu onto that, because the UEFI bootloader would say, you got no keys, you ain't coming in.
Could I even run a different copy of Windows 8? Just say I screwed up my Windows installation. Say. Might happen. If I got a new copy of Windows 8, like the one that didn't come pre-installed with that machine, would I be able to run that one?
Yes, you would if it was the same version. Depends on Microsoft what a player. But let's say Microsoft come up with another 25 different versions, like, you know, Pro, System, Ultimate, whatever, like they did Windows 7. Hmm. They could issue secure keys for you if our bootloaders for Windows 8 Home, Windows 8 Starter, Windows 8 Ultimate. And if you go and go, oh, I've got that, I bought the cheap one, now I'll go and get Ultimate. No play today.
I'm pretty confident that there's no benefits for them to do that. So I think because they wouldn't want manufacturers to have to say this chip only goes with this thing, and then they're locked in. You know, that seems like a bad idea. What I suspect the reality will be is that they would just put all the Microsoft keys in every UEFI, and those keys would include the bootloaders off of the installation disks. So a valid thing to boot from would be an installation disk of Windows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's how they get around that. So, you know, things that you're allowed to boot from with this computer is these six versions of Windows and these six install disks.
Right.
And I agree with that. I mean, John's put in the position there of what they're likely to do. I've put the position to you of what they could do.
What would put them in a position to do, yeah.
Now.
Neither way, I can't run Ubuntu, so.
No, exactly. No, you can't. Now, we should clear this up as well and be clear about this, because Microsoft made a very clear statement when the guys from Red Hat were basically, one of the kernel developers at Red Hat announced this and said, whoa, hang on a minute, if they go ahead doing this, Linux could suffer and not be able to install it on all of these machines. What Microsoft has said to the OEM licensees is that we are not forcing you to lock this UEFI bootloader. There's a locking mechanism that says you can't, that effectively says, don't let the user load an operating system that hasn't got a key. Right. And that should be switchable. So you can say, ignore the keys, load anything you like. That should be switchable. And Microsoft have said they're not going to force OEMs to do that. Now we'll see, wait and see, because if you can switch off the keys, then you can take the copy disks from Microsoft and load them onto there. So there's a disadvantage to doing that. But Microsoft obviously wants to be very careful about that, because back in 2009, it found itself in two places. It found itself up in front of the European Commission with the overseers there, basically with anti-monopoly legislation over its bundling of Windows Media Player and the anti-competitive bundling of Internet Explorer. Now, there are similar antitrust, anti-monopoly organisations in the States, and they ended up in front of them for this bundling of software and so on and so forth, for trying to create a cartel. And so Microsoft have got to be a little bit careful there of what they do.
It sounds a bit like they are being quite careful, you know what I mean? Like, it's all okay, it's all that crucial thing, so we're not going to force anyone to do anything, but here is a lovely little tool to protect yourself.
Well, it does, but the more you read into it, and obviously, as you know, as I talked about earlier on, with this particular podcast episode is being linked to the unit, which is this European Union investigative research reporting site that I'm obviously involved with helping. And there's an article in there that goes even further than this, because that's the one aspect of UEFI, but of course, and Windows 8 on PCs. However, it transpires that there was another article, another press release, where what Microsoft have said to the... Microsoft has a huge leverage with its original equipment manufacturers, the OEMs, because it provides the software to them. And if you make all of these PCs and they say, you're not having our software anymore, you just go out of business. It's as simple as that. And because you've got to be able to sell your devices with Windows on, because they've got such dominance in the market. So they have gone back to the original equipment manufacturers and said to them, well, of course, on PCs and Intel-based architectures, you can do what you like with the UEFI bootloader. But if it's ARM, it's got to be locked, and you can only load things with the keys. And that's if it's an ARM smartphone, if it's an ARM tablet, or if it's an ARM laptop.
Because they don't count as computers.
Well, yes, that's a really interesting point. This is where it gets sticky. Tablets and smartphones, if you can, the 2009 European Union's ruling was that you can't lock a monopoly, you can't bundle things in the operating system on PCs, personal computers. Now, there's more to this tale, because Windows are bringing out Windows 8, but they're also bringing out Windows RT, which is their tablet-based Windows for ARM-based devices. Mm. And what they've done with Windows RT is they have allowed Internet Explorer as the web browser to dig very deeply into the Windows 32 API, and also to hook into undocumented API components and all this kind of stuff. So it's a really deep level of integration. But they're not allowing Firefox, Safari, Opera, Conqueror, any of those other browsers to have access beyond the Windows 32 API. Now, the Mozilla Foundation were the first people to complain about this and started saying, wait, hang on a minute, you know, you're effectively trying to lock us out of the market. So they have, they've sort of raised a complaint, and God bless the European Union's Commission, and I'm not particularly, in fact, I'm not pro-EU at all. I have quite a negative stance on EU, but some things they do well and they do good. And it's great that the Commission overseers have said, hang on a minute, Microsoft, what are you playing at here?
Yeah, right.
And they're looking at this straight away. The difficulty that the Commission has is that in its writing legislation about anti-competitive behaviour, it speaks specifically about Microsoft cannot and will not, under our ruling, bundle software with PCs.
Right.
Now, if you can argue that a smartphone and a tablet isn't a PC legally, then all of a sudden that EU ruling can't do anything about that. So that becomes a a problem.
unless they can draft up something new, I suppose.
Yeah, unless they draft up something new. But of course, if they want to draft up something new, you can't just draft something up and hit Microsoft with it. You've got to take them into a core.
Yeah.
You've got to challenge them on it and prove the case, and it's got to be proved between a senior European judge before they'll effectively write that legislation in. So you would have to prove the case.
Which all takes time, I suppose.
And let's be honest, it's going to be tough on ARM, because essentially Google and Apple are already doing that.
Yeah.
They've locked down their systems already. and they're getting away with it fine, aren't they? So the implications are telling Microsoft, by the way, you've got to make it so you can install other OSs on your tablets and so that you can do this.
It's not going to go over, is it?
It's not going to fly, is it?
No.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you take this, most of the smartphones, for example, whether they be HTC, Samsung or whatever, you know, it's all the rage to root these things, which are not supported by the vendor. You know, you're not meant to do that. And you're actually cracking the phone, essentially, to put something like Cyanogen Mod or whatever you want to load onto it to effectively create a new operating environment that you have control over rather than the vendors have control over. Now, that's absolutely a lockdown situation. And if you take that at a high level, I think the problem that you face here is this idea of, it's a cartel. What you've got is a monopoly cartel when you lock the hardware manufacturer to the software manufacturer. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm going to make an exception here with Apple, because Apple manufacture the hardware, manufacture the software, and sell you a complete solution. And it's up to you. You can't go and buy, you know, Safari somewhere else. You buy it on an Apple device, and you've got half a dozen choices you can make, and if that's your market choice, I think that's fine. I don't see that as a monopoly on the market at all, trying to lock people out. But when you've got Samsung and HTC and all of these other device manufacturers and this plethora of PC manufacturers, and they are absolutely in hock with this software manufacturer, they're two completely separate companies, but they're effectively locking the product availability in the marketplace. They're also locking, in an abstracted way, price in the marketplace, and all of that strikes me as a monopoly and a cartel.
Yeah. A bit like, if you want to play with me, you can't play with them, sort of thing.
Yes,
and that's where the problem is.
Not
because Apple haven't done that, because they just make it all themselves. A bit like when you buy a television, you don't expect that to run something else. It's like your little set-top box from Sky. You don't expect to be able to install Windows on it, because it's a Sky box. We're running Sky software. But when you're buying a piece of hardware irrelevant of the system, it shouldn't be locked down to a system.
Correct, exactly. I mean, you should be able to go into a PC shop and make choices about whether you buy something with an operating system, without, or whatever. And if you go into PC World tomorrow, for example, you will not be able to go and buy a PC without an operating system on it, because you want to load your own operating system. You're going to have to buy it with some version of Windows. And you know, in some ways, effectively, the consumer's being strong-armed there, aren't they? They're going, and I want to buy a computer. Well, actually, you can only buy it if you buy this. Well, you know, that's strong-arming the customer.
That's right.
And so that's what all of this issue is about. Now, you know, the question is this right? Is this wrong? Should they be able to get away with it? Should, you know, I think this UEFI thing, Microsoft will leverage its OEM licensing agreements very strongly. And it's not difficult to say, for example, in your written work, you know, OEM licensing agreement, everything must have a key on it. And in the print is there talks about ARM and the OEM equipment manufacturer go out, right, and flog everything, PCs, laptops, tablets, the whole shooting match, with a lockdown UEFI BIOS. Now, you, the consumer, you won't know that BIOS is locked down and you can't install any other software onto it until you eventually come to do it. Well, now what if then modifying the BIOS voids your warranty? So the product is still fit for purpose and it does everything that you bought it to do, so you can't take it back on those Sale of Goods Act issues. But now you've discovered Ubuntu, or you've got some fancy new software that you want, operating system you want to load on it, whatever it might be, and all of a sudden you can't do that now with your hardware. Well,
I think there's two big concerns come to mind, sort of going back a little bit to the first half, I guess, with the UEFI for desktop machines. The thing that concerns me, that I suspect there's a reasonable chance of happening is Microsoft will go, hey, HP or whoever is selling computers in a year's time, we'll give you a copy of Windows and Windows 8. It's got the secure boot thing, as you know, but it's optional. But we'll give you £10 off if you lock it. You know, it's up to you. It's up to you. You can do what you like. But
you will.
£10 per copy, a million will. Copies.
You don't even
it's
have
to
make
you.
It.
It's up to you. But
it doesn't have to be offer. Official, does it?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be an official thing. It's just, I mean, the stuff, something like that could permeate is just a general understanding. It's like, yeah, you treat our software the way we want you to treat it, and we'll continue to give you...
Your discount that you're getting.
Yeah, right? That's it. We're not giving you this discount for any reason. We just really like you.
Yeah.
But
you know, the fact you're locking down the UEFI,
yeah.
that's good.
It's the easiest thing in the world to... I mean, it's pure semantics, isn't it? As to like what's being done and who's being told to do what. And effectively, you've got like, it's like the mafia, isn't it? Like, you've got these buffers in between different things when it's all the same organization, it's all the same thing.
It's just like that. I mean, no, it just is like the mafia, as you were saying that. You're absolutely right. Because, you know, my brother, I do good deal. Of course, I look after you, and I love you, and this and that. But really, the dagger's in your back, isn't it? You know what I mean? I mean, I hadn't thought about what you were saying there, John, but do you know what? That's absolutely. That's exactly the kind of strategy they would use, and it fits their MO perfectly. It allows them to go out to the press and say, no, we're going to give the OEM manufacturers the option. Of course we are, but we're going to incentivise the option.
Yeah.
And I think the second concern, and this is possibly more of a concern, is that in 2014 we turn on our computer and it comes up UEFI. By default it's on a warning. And there'll be three options. There'll be lock it so you can only run Windows 8, have it on a warning, so if you try and boot something else, it'll be like when you visit a website, this operating system is unsecure, do you wish to continue? Yes, no.
Yeah.
Or turn it off. That's what it'll be in 2014. 2016, the default will be on instead of a warning. 2018, there won't be a warning option, it'll just be on or off.
Yeah.
And there'll be a big danger sign next to off. 2020, there won't be an off option.
Yeah,
it'll just be the way it is now, and slowly and surely they'll take away our liberties until they're gone.
Well, that's the way it goes. Yeah,
they
chip it down, don't they? Yeah, sure they do.
Well, what was it with this? What was it they used to say? Windows ain't done till WordPerfect won't run. And that's exactly what they did. It was either WordPerfect or Lotus or one or the other, but basically when they were being competed against for Office suites, they just iterated the MS-DOS platform again and again and again with minor updates, minor updates, minor updates. And all the time, the core objective of all those updates was to just break the platform underneath Lotus and WordPerfect so that it wouldn't run. And when they reached that point, of course, they were then... People go, oh, WordPerfect, it doesn't load and it won't run. And, of course, WordPerfect are running their engineers ragged. Mm. And Microsoft are just beating them so that they could lock down the market with Office. And look what you've got now, where we are now. You know, you've got this distinct lack of choice. And worse still, you've got a distinct lack of choice with governments, public sector organisations that are holding what essentially should be open information in .doc format and various... iterations of .doc format, and you know, and I could go on. So you can see they've got plenty of history for doing this, and that's exactly the way they roll. This iterative process of locking the consumer down and locking the market down. Hence the reason why they're so dominant today, not because they've created the best thing since sliced bread. Windows is this wonderful platform because we've got tons of shows on
we're not
convinced of that. But they're brilliant at locking the marketplace down.
Yeah, they're clever. If only they were so clever about like actually making the thing. You know what I mean? If they could just come up with something that was robust, I wouldn't even be that bothered about like this kind of talk. But they're blatantly like they feel like the bad guys. They feel like the bad guys because the product just doesn't work properly.
Mm. I think the thing that kind of comforts me at the end of the day is like you said right back at the start of the evening. Whatever you do, there's a way around it.
Yes.
And if next year the whole hog happened and these BIOSes came out and they're all locked down to Windows 8, within 6 weeks, I'd say 12 weeks, within 12 weeks I'd put money on the fact there'll be a hacked firmware available.
They'd make a point of it, wouldn't they?
Run the XE, now you've got the off option. Yeah. Some hacker will just get all the firmware, you know, they'll make a firmware for every lockdown machine so that you don't have to be locked down.
Yeah.
And granted, that's an extra barrier. You have to learn how to do that.
Most people in the street would still be stuck with using Windows. But then again, they're not going to install, those people aren't going to install another operating system anyway, are they?
So, precisely. And the people that are reasonably techy, exactly the same things happen with everything. The Xbox, the PS3, the iPhone, the iPad, all get jailbroken and rooted. All the Android tablets, they all get jailbroken and rooted eventually. Granted, the PS3 did a pretty good job of keeping people off it for a couple of years. Yeah. But, you know, they got there in the end. Oh, there's the signing key. Someone will figure out that private key eventually, you know, especially with, they'll whack three GeForce 690s in their computer and they have 6,000 processing cores.
Yeah,
if that's what it takes to crack it, they'll do it. Yeah. You know, it's only like that would be $3,000 or whatever, but it's only $3,000.
Yeah.
And someone will hack it, they'll put it on the internet in a text file and that's it.
Yeah, just can't.
Just sign your OS with this key, done. And whatever you do, they'll get around it, you know?
I think what that... You're absolutely right, they will. And as you were talking there, and I just immediately just thought, I thought to myself, there's a great little money-making opportunity there, isn't there? You know, you just go and buy yourself a Raspberry Pi for 25 quid and you load onto that the ability to effectively plug that into a PC and mount that PC up like a device and then just flash the UEFI BIOS with it. And then you can sell that like for 100 quid with a bag full of Linux distros. And yeah, say, you know, yeah, you've got a new PC, you run whatever operating system you like. One Raspberry Pi, 100 quid, plug it in your machine, press go, poof, flashed, job done. So, I mean, of course it can be done like that. But what I think is bad about that situation is that, again, it's only the geeks and the nerds and the people on the fringes of technology, the kind of those more technically competent people that will actually do that. A great many of the consumers will just go away and just buy whatever and won't, you know, won't be able to experience that choice. Nor might they not, they might not want to, but by the same score, that means that the market space is less competitive. You know, at the minute you've got, you know, in the PC market, you've got Apple and Windows and in the, you know, charging up in the background and coming along is Linux trying to do its thing with Ubuntu, and what they're doing is absolutely uber awesome. But they're simply not competing in that market space at the moment. And that allows Apple and, if Apple are way up here with their prices, it allows Windows-based PCs to be inflated. And if you take away competition, it means always means a bad deal for the consumer.
It can't be a good thing. I mean, whichever way you cut it, you're having something taken away from you at the expense of more security. But that's always what governments tell you, isn't it? It's, oh yeah, we took away your toilets because security risk. Oh great. And terrorists are never going to strike anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like the hackers can like take down this stuff anyway, like you say.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll just go like another route round. All you did was like, it's all just about locking it down, really, isn't it? Rather than making it more secure.
There's absolutely no way, whatever Microsoft do, there's no way on earth that within 6 months of their first tablet coming out, there'll be Linux on it.
Yeah.
There's just no way, you know. It's just going to happen. Someone will go, oh, I've got Ubuntu running on it. And whatever, you know, they'll spend hundreds of millions on this UEFI technology locking it down. And they'll do it. And then if it ever goes to court, like the jailbreaking things, they'll say, don't be silly. It's their hardware. They can do what they like with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will it prevent them, though? Will it prevent Linux from getting any more ground? Is it a way to keep everything as it is rather than take over completely? Like, because they know, like, yeah, the Uber guys will hack it and, like, sort it out. But have they been worried about, like, more people uptaking other operating systems because it was getting easier, because it was getting more accessible, and that's what they're trying to slow down and stop? If so, that's a real shame.
it's worrying, isn't it? That could be there. They're preempting it. It's like, oh, Linux is getting popular. Let's add a barrier. Essentially what they're doing, adding a barrier. Because people who know Linux will buy the motherboards that aren't locked down. Yeah. There'll be a list on the Ubuntu.com somewhere.
Mm.
And they'll have, don't buy one of these 7 motherboards.
Yeah.
And then that motherboard manufacturer will suffer because they'll get a bad name. Not much, granted, but they'll suffer a little bit. But
again, that's in the PC builder market. So the Linux guys, the fringe geeks, will go out and do all of this, that and the other. I think absolutely it will make a huge difference to the growth and adoption of Linux Because, for example, you can go to ubuntu.com right now and say, please send me a CD.
Mm.
And they'll send you a CD for free in the post, and you whack it in your machine, and it all install itself on your PC, and then you've got Ubuntu, and you can go off and use that operating system as much as you like and do all of that good stuff. That won't happen. You won't be able to do that. You'll put it in, and it'll just go, no, I ain't playing. I'm not loading it.
I do... hang on, I'm trying to think... think of there's an obvious way around it. I guess no, can't stop there. I had a complete false thought. It was a no starter. I thought I had a genius idea, and then I went, "That ain't genius in the slightest." So think of an alternative. Try and get another clever comment in. And I was like, "Nah,
wait, no, sorry."
Don't worry, John. I've moved my hand away from the eject seat button. Fire him out of the conversation for saying something completely dumb.
Just got an electric shock, but it's all right.
How about this? I know they talk about in terms of, well, you guys have been talking about in terms of a Switch, of like this. I mean, what kind of thing are we talking here? Are we talking something that you could, if you had the guts to sort of like rip it open and get into the motherboard, could you flick something over? Or are we talking about something purely software based inside?
It'll be in that fancy little that new fancy BIOS screen that you see.
Oh, that's a shame. I was hoping it'd be something that like you could get in there, and like you could, I don't know, flick something around or reset something. It's something that like anybody could do without having to be getting.
Well, I guess in my fearsome 10-year worry that I said earlier, I guess one of those intermediary stages. So we'll start off. You'll push F2, and on the front screen it'll have a big thing saying "Secure boot on," and you'll just click it, and it'll go off.
Mm.
And then 2 years later, it'll be right back in one of the back menus. You have to go to advanced, boot, secure, ... Oh, there it is. Turn it off. 2 years later, it might be a little jumper on the motherboard or a tiny little flick switch on the motherboard. So it's just on unless you go tear your computer apart. Because again, it's making it just a little bit harder every time, but it's still there. So people can't complain. The government can't complain. They can't tell us this is illegal.
Yeah.
And then 4 years later, they'll say, "Oh, look, no one's turning it off anyway. We'll just get rid of it. Save some money. You can't arrest us for saving some money."
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And at that level, I mean, depending on the technology, but I mean, at the moment, most of these things are run in EEPROMs, E2PROMs, which EEPROM stands for Erasable Programmable Read-Only Memory, and it allows you to basically electronically write a load of software onto the hard chip and etch it into the silicon, if you like, and then to be able to electronically clean the silicon back and rewrite to it again. Now, the way they're controlled is there's a pin on the chip and that is the activator that basically unlocks the EEPROM and allows you to reprogram it and reflash it. And that can be activated on the board often, and that's what this DOS software does. You put a little bit of software in the machine and boot it up, it takes that pin high or low or whatever the trigger is, so it puts 5 volts on it or 0 volts on it, depending on whatever, puts the E2PROM into a state where it can be flashed, and then says, clear it and write the software to it. Now, obviously, UEFI will try to stop that and lock that out. But in a worst-case scenario, you could unsolder that chip off the board, shove it into an EEPROM blower, flash whatever you wanted to do onto it, or unsolder it and replace it with another one. So, you know, you could get your Uber motherboard that does all the stuff that you want that's locked in with UEFI, rip the E2PROM off it, put a new one in it with whatever software you wanted on it, and away you go. You can now use that hardware. But, you know, there's only a very limited number of people that have got the skills, knowledge or ability to be able to do that. Now, of course, what they could then do is offer that as a service to people. So just like we used to have radio ham shops where you would turn up with you. I used to turn up with my CB radio and say, like, I've got 40 channels at the moment. Can you give me lower sideband, upper sideband and 180 channels? And the little electronics guy would go, yeah, and get his soldering out and a load of chips and transistors and away you'd go. And you'd pay him the money and out you'd come with an Uber radio.
Yeah.
So you take your PC into the chip shop, man, he blows your ROM, and before you know it, you've got all of that sort of stuff. So,
which is exactly what used to happen with the PlayStations.
That's right.
When you get the mod chip
to run imports and backups of my backups, own games. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Make sure you're only originals. Here's how to back up your games. Disclaimer.
But anyway, the long and short of it is that, I mean, there are. I'm not for big government at all, and I'm not for globalisation and Agenda 21 and EU and all of that malarkey. I believe in independence and I believe in, you know, a light-handed government. But I have to say it's a really positive thing to see, you know, the European Union understanding the problem, understanding the nefarious and surreptitious work at hand, and already saying, you know, yes, the EU Commission overseers are looking at this and we've got our eye on you, and Microsoft, yes, if you do this, we will challenge you based on our 2009 ruling. So just mind your step, Barmer.
Yeah, it is nice, isn't it? And like you say, it's tough. I mean, either way, we're giving control to someone.
Yeah.
You know, are we saying that actually, yeah, we want these government officials, who probably aren't many of them even know what the discussion's about, do we want them deciding whether or not our platform should be open and therefore driving what our hardware and software company is doing, or should we be leaving it to Microsoft and then letting people vote with their feet? And actually, we don't want that because it's locked down, we're not going to buy it. But we know reality says that. Yeah. That's not what's going to happen.
No, right. Right.
So it's tough because we have to basically leave the decision to someone else, don't we?
Yeah.
It's just to decide who, really.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the best thing you can do is educate yourself and figure out how you're going to get that chip flashed when it finally gets to you.
But let us know what you think. You know, you've been listening to the show, you've listened to the details about it. What do you think about this? Do you think it should be legislated against? Do you think there should be more competition in the market? Do you think software should be separate from hardware? Or is it all okay and you just want to buy a consumer white goods product that just does something, anything? Or does that mean that, you know, Red Hat and Canonical should raise to the bar and start producing software with OEM manufacturers? There are loads of things out, loads of ideas. Email us and let us know, and we'll read some of these out on the show, I think, in future. I know we keep these shows on topic, but sometimes, so we don't read that many of the emails that we get, but, you know, send us something on this topic and maybe we'll have a session where we read some of those emails and read those out and debate some of your ideas as well. So, email address is show@atrandom.org, and the contact details are all on our website, www.atrandom.org. Get in touch, let us know what you think.
And make sure you mark your emails, free medication available now, ***. That way we'll make sure we get to them immediately.
I always prioritise those, Jack. Oh, brilliant, fantastic. Well, that's all my thoughts locked up for the day. So I've been John Wordsworth.
And I've been Rick Timmis.
I'm Jackson Matthews, TTFN.
Music is right, you start to scream and shout.